Welcome and greetings from the Latah Recovery Center, and welcome to this special edition of Recovery Radio. Today, we are having a question and answer session with Daryl Keim, the Executive Director of the Latah Recovery Center. Today, Daryl will be answering questions from members of the Latah County community about how, what, and why the Latah Recovery Center does what it does. Some of the questions have been sent in by concerned and curious citizens in Moscow and surrounding Latah County communities, and hopefully we'll have some questions asked live during the show today. This program will be posted to the Latah Recovery Center website after it airs on KRFP 90.3 FM here in Moscow Pullman area. As a podcast, you can download and share with friends and family. Now let's get to the questions and answers.
And I want to share that the fun for me of this is I haven't read all the questions. I don't know what's about to be asked of me.
Right.
So this could be really entertaining.
It could. We'll keep you on your toes.
Yeah.
Well, first off, I am Radio Johnny, and I am a Latah Recovery Center volunteer and radio host for Recovery Radio. And also here is Denise Miller.
Hi, and I'm an LRC volunteer, radio host for Recovery Radio.
And as you heard, we have Daryl Keim, the executive director at the Latah Recovery Center. Howdy, Daryl.
Hey, folks.
So first things first, what is the Latah Recovery Center?
Now, the Latah Recovery Center, for the stock boring answer, is a recovery community center that was originally started September 1, 2015. And it was based off of a model we found in Connecticut called the Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery is what we were based off of. And when we were first started back in September 2015, the idea was that we would have an information room like we currently have, where we would know about all the recovery-related resources in the area, a bunch of the state ones and some of the federal ones, and that we would also have support groups, which we do now. In fact, we average about 25 different support groups every week. Some of them are support groups like a 12-step anonymous program. Some of them are educational groups. Some of them are fun social groups. We have art classes. We have social gatherings like our Latah Recovery Center Festival on September 18th that's coming up over at East City Park. So the idea being that we would provide resources to the existing recovery community, in addition to representing the recovery community. And that's really what the model we were basing ourselves off of was all about, was becoming the voice of recovery, the voice of your local recovery community. So that's, in a nutshell, what the Recovery Center tries to do, is become that voice. And then the other service that we were designed to offer initially was and is recovery coaching, where we have folks with a lived experience with an addiction or a mental health issue. They've taken some training, and they help people by coaching them with setting life goals and recovery goals. That's how we started. We've grown since then. A few years after we started, we partnered with the Rural Crisis Center Network, and we now offer behavioral health crisis services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And that's all about crisis rather than recovery. So when somebody first comes through our door in the recovery center side, ostensibly, they're entering into recovery for some reason. They've decided that they don't want to live the lifestyle they've been living, and they're trying to cut back or completely eliminate drugs, alcohol, or work with their mental health condition. The crisis center is for somebody who's in a crisis right now. They need help right now, and the idea is they can come here, they'll get cuts in line to be to the front of the line to see a counselor. They'll get to work with that counselor to come up with a crisis plan and figure out how to work their way through that crisis. And then hopefully we'll see them on the other side of the door, where we'll see them in our recovery community center for more long-term help. And then, so we added that after a couple of years. And then most recently, we also added harm reduction. What harm reduction is, recognizing that some folks aren't ready to enter into recovery, but we need to keep them safe, we need to keep them alive. So we have a condom shop where people can get all kinds of different types of condoms. We have naloxone, which is an opioid reversal drug. So if folks are overdosing, we have naloxone available for folks that are high risk, that are going to a lot of those types of parties. They can have that in their car. If they see somebody that appears to be overdosing, they can administer the naloxone. And then we also have a safe syringe exchange, where people come in, and if they have used syringes, we want to keep them safe. We don't encourage that behavior, but we want to keep them safe. So if people have used syringes, they come in with five syringes, we'll give them five fresh syringes that are safe. Because if you reuse syringes, you can get MRSA and you get a variety of other diseases. In fact, when our board was discussing whether to take on the safe syringe exchange, one of our board members was very excited, and that was because she had reused needles. She'd nearly died. She contracted MRSA. A couple of weeks, I think it was, up in Spokane at the hospital that she spent, and I think the state spent something like $500,000 to keep her alive. It was not a good story, but it was a great story for showing the importance of why we need to have a needle exchange, excuse me, a safe syringe exchange, got to get that right, sure, here at the center. And we've had folks that access that. And that safe syringe exchange, like I said, they come in with five syringes, they leave with five clean ones. They also leave with the other works, clean water and things that they need in order to do that safely. And the nice thing is, and we've already seen this happen with the few people that have accessed that service here, that opens the door so that when they're ready and they're done with that lifestyle, they know who our recovery coaches are. They know who our counselor is. They know that we're not a scary place, and they're used to coming in the door already. So that's what the recovery center is nowadays.
All right. And the formal side of the recovery center, you're a 503c nonprofit.
Well, actually, that classification is called a 501c3.
Oh, 501c3.
It's an IRS
okay,
classification,
right.
And that does mean that we are a nonprofit that people can give charitable contributions to and take a tax write-off.
Okay.
And it also means that as a nonprofit, we have a nonprofit board of directors that has to meet certain standards for the IRS. In our case, our board of directors consists of over 50% people in recovery, so that we are maintaining a certain authenticity of voice when we say that we're trying to represent the recovery community. They keep us grounded and make sure that we're doing the things that the local recovery community needs. These are folks that are in 12-step anonymous groups, they're in mental health support groups. These are folks that are out there living the recovery life themselves. So when they get together and help us to come up with mission, goals, and direction, it's very much community-centered for Moscow.
That's important.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. How is the recovery center funded? I presume it's not all people
knocking on wood,
by and
prayer.
Lots of prayer.
Lots of knocking on wood, lots of prayer. Seriously, the recovery center is funded in several different ways. First of all, let's break the recovery center into the two businesses that it really kind of is. Let's talk about the recovery center. I was talking about both sides of the door. If you're ever in the recovery center, I'm being literal when I say that. When you walk into our center, you first walk into the recovery center. And if you walk in off Main Street, Moscow, you walk right into our resource room. And you'll see a big double set of doors that's usually closed. But if you walk in and you go through the double set of doors, you're accessing our crisis center. So you were asking about funding. I bring that up because we're part of the Rural Crisis Center Network, and they fully fund the Crisis Center. And the Rural Crisis Center Network is funded by the state of Idaho. So that half of our business is 100% state-funded right now. And I do believe that they have a mandate to become self-funded over time. But we're not completely in charge of that. That's the Rural Crisis Center Network. And we're essentially a site manager for them, with some staff that are specifically working with them and also with our recovery center. So it kind of blends very nicely and supports very nicely. The recovery center side of the business is funded a variety of different ways. For one thing, one of our biggest funders, we have a contract with the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare to provide recovery coaching, which is provided free of cost for everybody here at the center or here in Moscow. Anybody that comes through the door, recovery coaching is free. They fund that. That's probably a third of our recovery center budget. Another third of our recovery center budget comes from a lot of local support. We've got a couple of different fundraisers that we do. Moscow is fantastic about being supportive of the recovery center. So probably somewhere around a third or 40% of our recovery center budget comes from a big fundraising breakfast and dessert that we do typically around March. COVID last year really knocked down our numbers, so they were knocked down to about 150 or 200 people that came.
Right.
and we raised $45,000.
Wow, that's significant.
Which is a significant chunk of change. Years past, before COVID hit, we raised about that same amount of money, but we had about 450 people at that fundraiser, which was awesome.
Right.
Coming right up, we have Soups On, which is another major fundraiser for us. It raises around $7,000. And Soups On is wonderful because it's local restaurants each donate us 3 gallons of soup. We get somewhere around a half dozen restaurants. And then we sell tickets to it, and we get some business sponsors for it. And it's at the 1912 Center, I want to say Wednesday, October 25th, whatever the Wednesday is of the week of Halloween.
I think so, yeah, I think it's the 25th.
It's a great event. It's all about community. And it's as much a friend raiser as it is a fundraiser, and that's why I love it. Because we've got long tables, and it's about community conversations, and people from all walks of life are coming to this event, and they talk. And they have a bowl of soup, or maybe two or three bowls of soup if they're like me. It's as much as you can eat, so you can sample all the different types of soups that we've got available. So that's another fundraiser that we do.
27th, I just checked that. So 27th is the Wednesday before. And you can get tickets for that, by the way, right here at the Recovery Center.
Yeah, starting on the 15th, I think we'll probably have those tickets available.
Fantastic.
September 15th, to be clear on that. So that's local fundraising via that is an important part. Latah County is also a strong supporter for us. The Latah County Commissioners, the year we opened, they saw a very large decrease in their use of their county indigency fund. So they shared the love with us a little bit and passed on some of that savings to us, and they have every year since. So that's a very nice piece of the funding pie also. And then, you know, people, when they hear about nonprofits, they always think that grants are the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
So we do get some grants. That's not the bulk of our funding, but we do get grants that fund special little projects that we might do. Like we've got a small grant that's helping to fund some remodeling that we're going to be doing in the Recovery Center, and I'm looking for other grants that will fund that. I think I had a goal of something like $20,000 or $25,000 in grant funding last year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you were to figure that the entire Recovery Center budget is somewhere around $150,000. That kind of tells you how much grants fill in. And I shouldn't forget, the final piece of our funding pie is the Rural Crisis Center Network fully funds the Crisis Center, but we make a little bit of money off of that also to be spent in the Recovery Center. So we make some profit off of it.
Right.
So that we provide, or at least we hope to. It depends on how much staffing that the Crisis Center uses every year, of course.
Right. And we'll get into how that staffing for the Rural Crisis Center goes a little later on, because that's kind of a unique.
Yeah, it's unique, and it's also vastly different from the volunteers that run the Recovery Center.
Right. Now, we're going to get personal. Daryl, what qualifications do you have that make you the perfect fit to be the executive director of the Latar Recovery Center?
It's too bad we're radio. You'd see this big grin on my face. No such thing as a perfect fit, and I certainly don't think I'm a perfect fit. What makes me qualified? When they were looking for somebody 6 years ago that was going to be brave enough, stupid enough, whatever adjective you want to use, to start a recovery center in rural Idaho, I said yes. So that's my major qualification. Other important qualifications I have was I, at that point, was working for the Department of Health and Welfare, so I had some good contacts at the state level. And I knew all the local resources, which was pretty important as far as my state contacts. And also, and I think this is really important for at least when we started off, I'd lived in Moscow for a while, so I knew the community. And knowing the community meant that I was able to know the right people to call to say, hey, we've got this new idea that we're going to try and do. It's kind of new throughout the U.S. Here's what it is. And since I was a known entity, I was able to talk to people. And I was able to talk to the county commissioners. I was able to talk to the city council because they already knew me a little bit. Because my main qualification is probably the fact that I'd worked nonprofits before.
Right.
And we are a nonprofit, so that's different than other businesses.
Right.
You know, I don't have one boss. I have around a dozen bosses with a nonprofit board of directors. But yet, if you know nonprofits, you also know that while they're my boss, they're not my boss at the individual level.
Right.
Because collectively, there's 12 of them, they're my boss, but any one of them, like you, Johnny, or you're not my boss. No offense.
Right.
So you can't come in and say, hey, I'm the boss, and I get to tell you what to do. You'd have to get the board to vote and say, this is what you need to do. So
right.
And when you run a nonprofit and you're working with volunteer boards and volunteers, that's what I brought and what I continue to bring to the center was I've worked with volunteers most of my career. I spent 10 years as a professional Boy Scout. Go ahead, insert jokes. You know, they actually work. Isn't that just playing with kids? You know, I've heard all that stuff. And no, it's not. What I ended up doing for them is what I do here also. I recruited volunteers. I worked with a board of directors. I sold popcorn. I sold stuff, in other words, to cover local costs. And I fundraised. When I'm talking about I worked with volunteers, I worked with 1,200 volunteers.
Right.
So I had to be able to train volunteers. I had to be able to recruit volunteers. I had to be able to meet recruiting goals for kids. So I had to learn how to structure all of that into a volunteer organization and direct it, which is essentially what I do here, too, though we don't work with kids.
Right.
We work with volunteers. I have a small staff that does things like the coaching and does some of the trainings. I've developed some trainings. And then, of course, as a nonprofit director, I can hire staff to do a lot of things, but I do the fundraising.
Right.
So I'm the one, I'm responsible for the relationships with donors, the relationships with health and welfare, and the other contracts that we have to make sure that that all happens.
Sounds like a lot of really great experience that you've been able to put into here.
Sounds like I've lost a lot of hair in 6 years.
Yeah, I bet. It's probably a pretty hard job, actually. It sounds like you coordinate a lot of things.
It's a lot of fun, honestly. I've always believed work should be fun. Okay. And it's a lot of fun because it's different every day.
Yeah. You know, so this kind of leads into a little bit about what we've been talking about. What are your job duties as a director?
Everything I can't get the staff to do. So, you know, back when we first started, I did everything, literally. I was the staff, and very quickly I was able to hire a volunteer coordinator, and then I was able to divide it up a little bit. But I did some of the coaching, which people don't remember anymore. I did very little of that, by the way, because I had volunteers. But I recruited volunteers to do coaching. I coached the volunteers in how to do the coaching. I've always been a big believer in maximizing my efforts by using volunteers, because that's what you do with a nonprofit is you recruit volunteers to help you spread your mission
delegate.
Further out,
yeah.
And you delegate it out.
Mm-hmm. Seems like you oversee many things here. I mean, if people have questions, they come and ask you or they ask.
Really,
you know,
I think
staff.
Over time as we've grown, because, you know, I keep referring back to 2015 when it was just me and one other staff member.
Right.
We're now 5 or 6 staff members. Mm-hmm. And my job has become more to keep them going in the directions that they need to be going, and then also encouraging them to implement their good ideas. I think some of the most important parts of my aspects of my job is simply saying yes to other people. Yes, we can do that. Yes, that's a good idea. Let's make that happen.
Mm-hmm. You're raising up people like you to be
trying
able
to,
you know, that's pretty cool.
Trying to.
That takes talent.
Let's see. When it comes to you talked a little bit about fundraising and budget. Who actually decides how that money gets spent?
That is one of the key parts that a board of directors does. And in our case, we've been very fortunate because I always hire staff and I recruit volunteers to fill my own weaknesses. I think I'm pretty good at fundraising. I would be a horrible, horrible accountant or treasurer. We recruited on our board, and we have people that are accountant types and treasurer types. And our board is very blessed to have a CPA. He's actually currently the president of the board. So our books are kept very clean, and the direction in our budgeting process is very much a by-the-books process. So in our case, we have a finance committee that meets every month. And they come up with the budget once a year, which is then taken to the board and approved by the entire board. The finance committee kind of tracks that, makes sure that our funding goals and our expenses are all tracking with how we expect. And in our case, you know, we're lucky. We've been here for 6 years, so we've got some data to look back on and say, here's what the trends usually have been over the past few years. And our funding is very interesting in that it's lumpy. So what I mean by that is we'll have some months where it looks like we're going in the hole. And, you know, it looks like, gosh, if this trend was to continue, we need to have the fire sale.
Right.
But
right.
since we've got the data and we know how we get a certain amount from the Latah County Commissioners every January, we have this fundraising event that brings in 35 to 45 every March, then we know when the big lumps come in, so we can see what that pattern looks like overall. I think that we're very blessed as far as the transparency of our funding goes.
Mm-hmm.
Having a board that actually has an interest in funding.
Right.
My experience, I've been on, in addition to my work with the Boy Scouts, I worked for Sojourners Alliance, and I've been on their board. I've been their board president, in fact, and I've been on other boards. And the hardest thing to get a board interested in doing is paying attention to the money until there's not enough of it, and then it's too late. Our board pays attention to the money from the start and makes sure that our budgets are in place and makes sure that things are following how they're supposed to. And because of that, we're a much stronger board than most boards that I've seen that are constantly trying to figure out why don't we have enough money at the end of the month.
That's pretty helpful. That's probably a big reason why you guys have done so well for so many years and will continue. That's awesome.
I would say so.
Yeah.
My experience with nonprofits has been getting people to access the services is never a problem, but I can't charge my customer. So, you know, it's like I'm a movie theater, but I'm offering free movies. How do I keep it open? Well, that's where the nonprofit aspects come in, and that's where that finance committee comes in. So they're paying attention to the grants we need to write. They're paying attention to the fundraising we need to do, helping come up with all that budget.
Mm-hmm. It's awesome keeping track of things.
Yeah.
That's good.
And, frankly, keeping us honest.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that some of the money we get, certainly some of the money from the state, comes with certain strings, so to speak.
Ropes.
Yeah, and what kind of things are those? Like, do we have to show that people are coming in the door, or do we just provide them with data on an annual basis? How does that work?
The answer to that is yes to everything you just said. So it really depends on the different contracts. And you say the state, so you know the state, we've got the state contract with health and welfare. But then we also get grants, and different grants have different stipulations, too. And when you're working in the nonprofit world, the best money is the money that you raise at, like, a fundraising event, because it's given with no strings attached.
Right.
So we've got a variety of different strings, depending upon which funding you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, for state contracts, the state has been very good to us. And there's actually 9 recovery centers throughout the state of Idaho that the state helps to fund. And for all of them, the state has been good because they haven't had the major strings that you think of when you think of federal and state contracts. We do have to report in every month with how many people have accessed our recovery coaching program. And they have to take a survey, and they have to take it every 3 months. So if they're accessing our recovery coaching services, and it tracks all kinds of different data showing the effectiveness of our program. So it's actually a good survey that they need to take, and we look at the results ourselves to analyze our own effectiveness.
The strings aren't
too bad. It's a monthly report to the state. The grantors typically are quarterly reports or maybe even less, depends on how big the grant. And some grants just say, here's a check.
So, right. We even got a check from a group here in Moscow that was just kind of a surprise.
Yep.
Like, here's some money.
Yeah, that happens every once in a while, too. I find the harder you work, the luckier you get that way.
But I think people do recognize that, you know, something positive is going on here. So
absolutely.
The LRC uses, you talked about a little bit, a peer-to-peer recovery model. And that's to say the people in recovery from alcoholism work with people who are struggling with alcoholism. People with mental health issues help others with similar issues. And that requires a pretty broad range of volunteers. How does the LRC attract volunteers with those different skill sets?
It's really changed over the last few years. Initially, when we first opened, I'd gone out and I talked to a large variety of different community groups, and I told them what we were doing, and we got a number of different community members that volunteered with us for very long periods of time, actually, and they would become what we call a recovery peer volunteer, which is our local version of a recovery coach. Over the years, that's kind of changed a little bit, and then COVID really hit us hard because a number of those volunteers were older, so they isolated for the most of the year, and some of them are still isolating. Pre-COVID, we had about we had a bunch of volunteers, but we had about 10 of them that were had taken that recovery peer volunteer training and were able to help with the coaching aspect of things. So post-COVID, I'd say we were around 3 or 5 that are doing that, and they're doing less of it than they used to, but it's getting better. That's part of what we have volunteers do, and that's part of how we've gotten them in the past, at least, was I would go out to the different groups and actively recruit. I've become busy enough that it's become difficult for me to do that. So knock on wood, in my dreams, we're working to try and find somebody to take on that aspect of my job and do some of that volunteer coordinator type of work, getting the word out about with the local community about what our needs are and what our opportunities are for volunteering. What's kind of swung in, though, and made the difference for us as COVID hit is the University of Idaho. We started getting more interns and more students that wanted to volunteer or actually be a regular intern. And we've had master's level interns. We've had bachelor's level interns. So usually they're interested in some sort of counseling or something like that. So it's a little different. And not all of them can be recovery peer volunteers. To be a recovery peer volunteer, you have to have a lived experience with an addiction or mental health issue. And 18-year-olds just don't typically fit that bill. 22-year-olds pursuing a master's may or may not. So it's kind of varied a little bit. So our volunteer program's kind of changed a little bit. And with post-COVID, we're hoping to go back and be more actively recruiting volunteers like how we started with. So that talks about one type of volunteer. There's also another type of volunteer. So we've got the volunteers that are doing the recovery peer volunteer, the recovery coaching things. And then we've got other tiers of volunteers that have different levels of training. We've had some very solid community volunteers that just, they don't want to coach, but they want to come in and help at the front desk. So we continue to have that. And then we also get community service volunteers, be that community service from a school or be that from a judge. So they come in and they don't keep the doors open, but they keep the floor clean, if you know what I mean. So those are the different types of volunteers. You know, if somebody's hearing this and wants to volunteer, give us a call.
Right. Even if you don't have, what it takes to do that peer-to-peer, having what we call allies is also a really great thing.
Yeah. And for those of you guys that like numbers, pre-COVID, we averaged 200 to 250 volunteer hours a month. Post-COVID, of course, it depends on where we were at in that COVID process.
Yeah.
When everybody was closed down, we remained open, but we didn't have any volunteers coming in. And now, so let's say now, we're at about 150 volunteer hours a month.
So it's swinging back up.
That's the point I was making.
It's always good to improve that if possible.
And, it would be nice to be above our pre-COVID numbers, because that was enough to keep us open, but we couldn't be doing outreaches I would like to see, outreaches to the rural communities, outreaches to the university. That was enough to keep our doors open and us very busy. But the more volunteers we have, the more we're able to help the community.
And the peer volunteers, you kind of briefly spoke of it, special training. You mentioned there's levels.
Yeah, there's levels. So when everybody that comes through the door, no matter whether they're a professional psychiatrist or whatever, that they want to volunteer here, they're going to start at level 1, tier 1, and we're going to teach them how to work the front desk, and they're going to work their ways through tier 2, 3, 4, and 5. And if they want to become a recovery peer volunteer, they're going to work their way all the way up. They can stop at any tier they want, and they can say, I'm really happy with what I'm doing here with cleaning or with answering the phone and helping people as they come into the recovery center and ask questions. So it depends on where they want to be.
Right, but that training is available,
And so there's different levels of training.
Special skill set.
So not everybody needs to take our 6-hour recovery peer volunteer training, but everybody needs to take our basic introductory training and learn what it is we offer. And then if they're going to be working the front desk, they need to be trained in how to answer the phone, things like that, so the different trainings come along. And if they're working with private records, they need to take our HIPAA training.
And that's actually something, too. Very strict on the HIPAA protocols here, having had experience with that. And that's, I think, something important for people to understand that
Now, we try to
maintain,
you know,
people's,
we're not perfect,
privacy.
And the recovery center is run by volunteers. Crisis center, by the way, is run by certificated counselors and professionals. So it is that, again, that two halves of the building. But just by way of example, you talk about meeting HIPAA compliance. Of course, we have the expectation people don't talk about who they've seen here. I don't. You know, I might go home and tell my wife a story about what happened at the recovery center, but I'm not going to say, you won't believe what that Radio Johnny did.
She wouldn't believe it anyway.
Yeah, that's probably true. Another example is, you know, we maintain records of who accesses our, especially our recovery coaching services. But in an attempt to maintain privacy, we don't put people's names on them. Instead, we code them with a numerical code so that any random person was to get into our files, they can't look up Radio Johnny and say, oh, look at that guy. That's really interesting.
He's done all these things.
Instead, they would have
to
know
that Radio... He's all trained up.
This is a thick folder.
It's going to take over the world.
They'd have to know that Radio Johnny is number 12346.
Right.
Yeah.
And look that up. And this one's more controversial amongst the different recovery centers throughout the state. But I've taken the stance, we don't allow pictures of our people. We don't advertise who's in recovery. We don't do anything like that. Well, if the radio or the newspaper calls and they want to talk to somebody in recovery, I'm not going to say, yeah, here's Radio Johnny. What I will say is, let me talk to some folks. What's your phone number? If somebody's interested, they'll call you. And then I've never done anything where before or after pictures are really popular, for instance, with recovery centers.
Right, yeah.
Because it's really nice to show what Johnny looked like when he was in the height of his addiction and then what he looks like 6 months into recovery, because he's going to look like a whole different guy. A lot of the recovery centers throughout the state do that, and we don't do that even. Just to my way of thinking, there's an issue there that I don't like.
Yeah, anonymity is an important thing.
Yeah,
for people in recovery, and I think in the small town environment,
exactly what I was just going to say,
it's even more critical.
Maybe for the guys in Boise, you know, where you're 1 in 500,000, maybe that's not a big deal. But around here, somebody's going to know exactly who that person is and might work with them.
Yeah, and it's each of our own stories to share about our recovery when it seems like it's the right time.
We do have paid professionals here, though, as well, don't we?
We do. We have, so the volunteers really keep the lights on and make it possible for us to have a staff of five that keeps the center open from 10 to 8 Monday through Friday. You know, and always has at least two people here, because we have that requirement too for safety's sake, for everybody's safety. We never have less than two people, one staff and one volunteer. So the volunteers make it possible for us to have that many hours. But we have, obviously I'm paid staff, I work part-time here.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, most of our staff is part-time and not full-time. We have a recovery coach. She works here full-time, thanks to the state of Idaho funding that. We have a part-time, Sean's title's not going to come to me, sorry, Sean, but he works with the crisis center. He also does some volunteer coordinating for the recovery center, so he does both sides of the house. I think he's 30 hours a week, and he's also an on-call worker. That 24/7, 365 that the crisis center is open. He's one of two people that's on call. We have another guy who's the other on call worker who also works less than 10 hours a week here. And then we have a counselor that's here about 25 hours a week.
Right, and we hope to interview Colleen coming up.
Yeah.
Possibly even she'll be on the air next week.
And you had mentioned, now is probably a good time to loop back to, you want to talk about the unique way that the crisis center is staffed.
Exactly.
Going back, remember the recovery center is one side of the house and the crisis center is the other. Recovery center is staffed by a couple of our part-time staff, including the recovery coach, and then volunteers. The crisis center, on the other hand, is staffed by professionals. They've got a full education. They're a certified counselor or certified CBRS worker, but they are certified and professionals in their field. And that's who's running the crisis center. But we don't have them here all the time. And that's the magic of the crisis center and why we're able to offer crisis services 24/7, 365. With the budget that the state gave us, because we don't keep it staffed 24/7. Instead, there is a phone number that you can call. It's a central dispatch office. It's an 877 number, and it's been given to local emergency services personnel. It's on our front door, so anybody can call it. Hospital knows it. And that starts the ball rolling so that once that number is called and they ascertain that they need to go to the Rural Crisis Center Network facility in Moscow rather than the one in Lewiston or the one in Orofino, then Sean or our other on-call individual gets a call if it's after hours, and they say, hey, you need to open up the center, and we got somebody coming in for a crisis. And that's what makes that unique, is there's a number of different crisis centers throughout the state. There's one in each region of the state. But most of them are fully staffed. There's only one bricks and mortar building for the entire region, whereas we've got three and are hoping to have four. Most of the crisis centers throughout the state are taking people out of their realm of comfort and out of their community, or they're really only serving like one community. So Coeur d'Alene, for instance, their crisis center serves all of North Idaho, but if you're in a crisis in Sandpoint, you have to drive to Coeur d'Alene. Whereas if you're in a crisis in Lewiston, you go to Lewiston. If you're in a crisis in Moscow, you go to Moscow. If you're in a crisis in Beauville, you can go to Orofino, Lewiston, or Moscow, and odds are you know somebody there, and you're within your support network. So what's unique about ours is, one, it's got multiple facilities, and two, we don't have staff there all the time, unlike what you'd see in Boise or Coeur d'Alene, where they have a doctor there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They have a nurse there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they have security there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can imagine how much that costs.
Mm-hmm. A bunch.
Yeah. So we're able to have more facilities and kind of just-in-time delivery for the counseling. And when I say we, I'm talking the Rural Crisis Center Network that we contract with. And we've gotten calls from the East Coast from folks, I think they were in Maine, that were looking to replicate the model because it's that unique.
As a matter of fact, we're going to be posting up to the Latah Recovery Center website, latahrecoverycenter.org, a talk that you and Joyce Lyons gave about exactly about that, how this novel approach to rural crisis is being handled and done, and a lot of good information in there too if you want to learn more about it.
And Dr. Lyons, just for you guys that don't know, is the person that's in charge of the Rural Crisis Center Network. So she brings a wealth of expertise when she talks.
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting.
A very passionate person about mental health and crisis. I believe she retired once and came back to actually
get this project going. She retired from the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, where I worked for her before I went to work here. In fact, she's the one that assigned me to develop this. And then she went to work for public health in order to implement the Rural Crisis Center Network.
Glutton for punishment, I'm telling you.
Opting to work with me twice is highly unusual. So let's just leave it at that.
I'm just not going to go there.
But she actually chose to work with me the second time, which is just probably freakish.
So here's a question from Chris K. from Kendrick, Idaho. And she asks, how does the LRC respect, encourage, and value its volunteers?
How do we respect, encourage? I think we respect them by giving them opportunities. Mm-hmm. And volunteers, you know, we get, as I said earlier, all kinds of volunteers. And we're talking folks that are here from a nudge from a judge all the way up to local business leaders that are on our board of directors. And we give them all the same opportunities. They can volunteer whatever level they want to the degree that they want. And we're going to do our best to make sure that they're trained and able to succeed. And I think that's the best way you can respect a volunteer, is to set them up to succeed.
That's awesome. Is the LRC progressively growing and expanding and or adapting to challenges like COVID?
Well, I think as we talked earlier, given that time frame of how we have in fact expanded, you know, first we opened on September 1, 2015, then a few years later, we doubled the size of our space by incorporating in the crisis center. And then just a few months ago, we added the Safe Syringe Exchange. We've grown our staffing during that same time in order to be able to meet all those needs. So I think we've done pretty well with that.
Yeah.
And we look to continue to do that. Proactively, in fact, we've contracted with a builder to this fall redesign the recovery center to improve privacy. Because that's one of the chief complaints we've gotten from different groups and individuals is, you know, you want me to bare my soul, but it's a wide open room. going to build some staff offices. We're going to continue to have the large meeting room with a large table, but with a wall and a long hall, trying to find the perfect balance between that open, friendly feel that we currently have and some privacy also. So the hall will be long enough that people can actually, wide enough, we can put some tables there, kind of cafe tables like we've got out front, that, again, people, I never want to say hang out because that sounds bad, but people that are here because it's a safe space might look like they're hanging out sometimes, and we want them to be comfortable too.
Absolutely, you need to be able to talk with each other, and that's good.
That social value for recovery is a big part of what we provide, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Is the LRC visible and available to rural Latah County, especially Kendrick and Julietta?
You know, we've tried to be, and we continue to try to be. In the past, we received some funding to try and do some community outreaches to rural Latah County. And in fact, the state funded all 9 recovery centers to do some outreaches, and some of the recovery centers were able to actually start little mini recovery centers, like Pocatello started something in Soda Springs. So I got curious because I was talking to the director, Chris, and he was talking about how they were able to increase their rural service. I was like, why can't I do that? I would love to do that. And then I looked and I realized that Soda Springs is rural, but it's a population that's bigger than any other Latah County town, aside from Moscow, of approximately, I believe it was 3,000, which is not a big town, but the next biggest Latah County town is approximately 1,500 or 1,000. So we had to try something different than just replicating what we were doing in a smaller town, because we're already the rural outreach in Moscow by a lot of people's definitions. Mm-hmm. We're one of the 2 smallest towns to have a recovery center that's funded by the state. And the other ones within the greater Boise Valley area, so I don't really call them remote.
Right.
Just as an aside. We got funding from the state. What we attempted was, I called it a spoke and hub design for trying to get 12-step anonymous groups started again in the rural communities. And we had a person hired, and their job was to go out, and we asked them to focus in Potlatch and Deary to start with, just because they're relatively big. And Chris asked specifically about Kendrick. Kendrick was another 20-mile drive. So we tried to start in close, and the idea was to grow those, and then we would go around to different Latah County towns.
Sure.
With the idea being that when I say spoken hub model, the hub would be Moscow, and we would use Zoom, and this person would go out, and they would develop meetings all on the same night in the different communities was the idea. Mm-hmm. With the idea being, okay, we'll have Wednesday nights be rural recovery nights for whatever 12-step group we might be using. And so they started in Potlatch, and they went to Deary, with the idea being starting little bitty groups in these small towns, because they don't have support groups right now for 12-step variety, and there's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. They're small towns.
Yeah.
So the idea with the spoken hub was that they would get these groups going, and the hub would be, they'd be able to have these groups all connected via Zoom. So they might have 2 people in Potlatch, but they'd be able to be connected to a group of 8 in Moscow and get some critical mass. We were going with that, and honestly, it wasn't working great, but we were starting to get it going, and COVID hit. Mm-hmm. We were partnering with local churches, local libraries to make that happen for our locations.
So like looking for a meeting place so everybody could get together, and then
people stopped meeting.
Yeah.
So we currently have a Potlatch group that has spun back up. They're not doing the Zoom thing, but they're meeting. And if I can figure out the funding for it, I'm committed to 2 outreaches if I can figure out the funding. Rural, because our rural citizens desperately need recovery services.
They do, yeah.
In fact, our rural communities look like inner city as far as their need for recovery services from the data I've read. So I'm committed to rural if we can find the funding for it, and college outreach for fairly obvious reasons.
Right.
The college does have their own programs through their, what do they call it, their health and welfare.
Through the Center for Counseling and Testing Services, they have some programs, and they have some counseling available to the students.
Right.
We've worked pretty closely with them to try and add our own student recovery programs.
Right. Well, Vandal Recovery
Is
a program.
So the college, last year, again, COVID,
Right.
We picked the world's worst year to try and kick off a college program with Vandal Recovery. And we were working hand in glove, I will say, with the Center for Counseling and Testing Services and the other relevant folks over at the University of Idaho. And so we have Vandal Recovery, that where we're trying to mimic what we're doing with recovery coaching here. And in fact, we have made contact with Campus Christian Center, now known as the Center, for a location that we're hoping to be able to announce soon as starting, but it hasn't happened yet. And we worked very, very closely with Center for Counseling and Testing Services with their Vandals for Recovery program. So we had Vandal Recovery, they had Vandals for Recovery. No confusion there, of course.
No, I'm sure there.
We're continuing to push that because Chris asked about rural. And like I say, we're committed to if I can find the funding, but it takes so much less funding for me to have my staff walk down the street to a place that it's basically renting us a facility for free for on-campus location.
Right.
So we're able to do that very easily compared to the rural effort.
Right, because that's a long drive. That is a long drive.
It's not just the drive, but it's the staff time.
Well, yeah, exactly. The long drive equals, that's staff hours just commuting back and forth.
Right.
That's an hour and 10 minutes. And,
right.
And then actually spending the time there.
Right.
And even if you're just setting up or organizing for, say, an AA meeting or something, you got to be there a half hour early and make the coffee, put the literature out.
In the case of our rural outreach effort, I didn't mention this earlier because I didn't want to confuse the issue, but we tasked a certified counselor to go out and do that. So we were paying counselor rates. And she was worth every dollar of it, of course, but we're paying counselor rates for her to go out, try and start whatever anonymous group was going to start, and then also provide free counseling in that community during the hour or two when that anonymous group was meeting.
Right.
And we just didn't get the turnout
to
make it worthwhile. She did very little counseling, even though we tried to publicize it as best we could. But again, people weren't coming out because of COVID. Publicizing things in small towns, well, the daily news, people just don't read the Moscow Pullman Daily News all that much.
No.
Mm-hmm. So how do you publicize? We tried to do word of mouth, we tried to do social media,
mm-hmm.
but don't take this wrong, anybody, but the folks in recovery aren't necessarily paying attention to those types of media outlets.
Right.
Or I shouldn't say the folks in recovery, the folks that are entering recovery aren't necessarily paying attention to those media outlets.
Right. It's word of mouth. It's through literally face-to-face information,
Takes time to develop.
Right. You can even have a community meeting and, you might attract a couple of people that actually need the services, but the hope is that you're going to contact people who know people who may need those services. And bring them in, but still, that's what you can.
My experience with the community meeting, and I've been to many, is that you get the folks that don't need the services.
Right.
They're supportive of you. They see what needs to be done, but they don't need those services themselves. So, best you'll get is what you were talking about, and that is, hey, I was at this meeting about the recovery center. You seem like you could use the service, but that's a much slower growth than the actual people at the meeting.
Right. From Debbie Hornbuckle, resident here in Moscow, in regards to the harm reduction program, you talked a little bit about what it is and how we administer it here. But she wonders, has there been research done that show it really works? Because it sounds like one step in a long process.
Well, I think that's a fantastic question. And the answer is it is one step. It's the beginning step in a very long process. In fact, I think Johnny and Denise, probably more experienced, could tell you guys on the radio better than me, mm-hmm. recovery is a lifelong process. And certainly harm reduction is hardly even the beginning, because you're just trying to get the people to love themselves enough to care about their own health mm-hmm. more than the drug that they're trying to get, so that you can then help, hopefully, get them to enter into recovery rather than die from an overdose or die from a dirty needle, whatever it might be.
Right.
So there's that aspect of it. The reason why it's such a good question is because it allows me to talk about something called the SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. We're not the first to do this stuff. So the research is already out there. And in fact, why I'm so excited to talk about that is all of our programs at the Recovery Center are what's called SAMHSA evidence-based. So that means that the federal government has spent God knows how many millions of dollars already doing the research on this stuff, and they have said, hey, recovery coaching, that's SAMHSA evidence-based. Counseling, that's SAMHSA evidence-based. 12-step mm-hmm. anonymous groups, those are SAMHSA evidence-based. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff, they've already done. They've had the scientists and the people that are far dorkier than I ask all the questions, look into all the answers, get all the statistics, and say this is SAMHSA evidence-based. It's the gold standard, in my opinion, for what you want to be offering. And when our committee went to look at adding harm reduction, that was one of the questions we asked. And yes, it's SAMHSA evidence-based. And you got to know that in a conservative state like the state of Idaho, if they're saying that something like this that's fairly radical, giving people clean needles so that they don't kill themselves with MRSA or other problems like that, and giving them naloxone so they don't overdose, in a conservative state like Idaho, if our state is willing to fund it, you got to know there's strong evidence for that.
Right.
And in fact, there is. It's very easy to find if you look it up online. And in fact, I looked it up online. So you asked about harm reduction. I'll tell you a quick story about how we got it here in Moscow. I was contacted by the North Idaho AIDS Coalition, and we partner with them to provide the harm reduction materials, much like we partner with the Rural Crisis Center Network to provide the crisis center way. Many months before we started the harm reduction, and they just wanted to come down and they wanted to provide HIV and hepatitis C testing. So of course I said yes, because I one of the things I do here is I say yes to people. And they started coming down, they provided the free testing, and we started talking to them more. They said, if you're ever interested, we do these other things. And they gave me a menu of different things that they do, including Sharps disposal boxes, because that's part of what you need to have for a safe syringe exchange, obviously.
Yeah.
Condom shop, naloxone, many of the things that we ultimately ended up doing. But we didn't say yes right away. And the reason for that is our location. We're on Main Street in Moscow. And I was kind of nervous about being all the way into harm reduction. Mm-hmm. I didn't start more seriously thinking about partnering with NIAC more intensively than just the tests, the Hep C and the AIDS tests, until one day somebody came into my office and they said, hey, Darryl, you need to go out to the picnic table out there at our front window outside. And I was like, why? And they said, I think there's a pop pipe there. And I was like, ah, crap. That does not look good for the recovery center. Because I'm very image conscious. We're on Main Street, Moscow. We need to be good neighbors for Mikey's and for sure. One World and all that. So I hightailed it out there. Sure enough, it did look like a pop pipe. And I was like, this is a bit of a conundrum, because if I pick this up, I have now taken possession of a pop pipe. And then I didn't have much problem with that. But then, so I walked into my office, I was like, what if that had been a syringe? Because then I'd be in possession of a syringe, which is quasi-legal. If you're a syringe exchange, it's not quasi-legal. It's legal. But more importantly, my mind went right then, was if this was a syringe, I would just as quickly want to clean it up off the street. But what would I do with it? Because I don't have any safe needle boxes in the shop. So I thought to myself, NIAC has those, and I can get them for free. So I was like, okay, I'm going to talk to NIAC. So I emailed NIAC, and I said, well, tell me more about this harm reduction stuff. What supplies do you have? And they said, you can start at this level with condoms, and if you want, you could have a safe syringe drop-off, not an exchange, just by getting these boxes. And I started thinking, that might be a good idea. And then they said, but the full bore is a safe syringe exchange, where you've got all this stuff that we've already talked about. And I said, well, my job is to say yes. And this is one of those where it's too big for me to say yes to any one of these levels of the little shopping list that they gave me. So I'm going to take it to the board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
But I present the list, and honestly, I expected that the board would say, yes, let's do the syringe drop-off, because that had some nice benefits. It gets syringes off the streets. It keeps them away from kids. It keeps them out of parks where people drop them. All those things that you don't want to see syringes at, because they're very dangerous. I was nervous about being the guy that opened a syringe exchange on Main Street in Moscow. So I presented to the board, I gave them all the options, and one of our board members said, I am so excited to see us looking at this. I had been an IV drug user, and I contracted MRSA, and I'm aware of other people. And she was practically jumped up on the table, in my opinion. She was so excited. And the board saw that that was a service that we need in town. So then it became a matter of, we need to investigate how we can do this. Do we do it here at our center? Is there a way to find another center, another location? And it went from there. But the board decided that it was important service, and I was to implement it. So that's my story about how harm reduction came to town, was because I found a Popeye.
Also in that board meeting where we were considering going forward with that, we also had the public come in.
Yes, we did.
Put on it. For the most part, it was overwhelmingly for having a program there. But we did have people speaking.
There were some against. Very good arguments against it.
Yeah.
And some very passionate people, but the board felt that they needed to vote how they voted. And
right.
They did. The most people, even the folks that were against developing a safe storage exchange, for most of them it was that they didn't want to have it at the recovery center, which they considered a safe space. And once we explained to them it wasn't going to be open all the time, most of them came around. Some of them still didn't for a while. But it was a matter of listening to their concerns and addressing their concerns and then saying, this is how we currently are thinking of it. You guys have some good concerns. What if we tweak it with these changes?
It's not only just a safe syringe pass off. Here's my dirty ones. Here's my clean ones.
It's also a small, lowercase c, in my way I think of it, counseling.
Right.
Where they're counseled. Here are the recovery options that are available right here. It's building a relationship.
Right. And there's also mandatory HIV and Hep
yes.
C testing.
Yes.
If they want to take advantage of the program as
yes.
well, which I think is probably even bigger. I mean, if somebody is you know, actively using, I know, you know, in my particular case, what doctors told me really didn't influence
well,
me all
I mean,
that
do
well.
Do you go to the doctor when you're actively
right.
using intravenously? I didn't.
Right.
So I wouldn't have known.
Right. But, you know, regardless, at least, you know, that's another thing that is important for people to know to maybe help them make a decision to, wow, you know, maybe, you know, it is time for a change.
Yep.
And go on from yep. there. So I think that's important, too.
And so as long as we're talking about this, can I give a little speech?
Sure, certainly.
So I find it interesting. In the state of Idaho, they made it legal to do a safe syringe exchange within the past couple of years. So I can I can exchange syringes on that 1-for-1 ratio. I can give out naloxone, which is the opioid reversal drug we discussed. But one of the standards that is used in a lot of states that also saves lives is illegal for us to do in Idaho. And that is a lot of drugs. In fact, most of the overdoses from drugs nowadays are not caused by the actual drug the person purchased. They're caused by fentanyl, and it's extremely deadly.
So deadly.
One of the things that I would love to be able to do, and in fact I've reached out, and I know the Department of Health and Welfare has also reached out and is trying to change the law here in Idaho, for pennies. We can give out fentanyl testing strips when somebody comes in and exchanges their needles. And then they can find out whether the drugs that they think they are taking are laced with fentanyl that'll overdose and much more likely to kill them.
When you're prescribed it from a doctor, it's going to have the exact actual amount that's in that.
And it's diluted, it's in a patch.
Right, exactly.
Fentanyl is so deadly.
And even that by itself can accidentally, like.
Yeah, easily.
I mean, easily you could, you know. But gosh, I can't even imagine on the street.
I remember talking to the chief of police here in Moscow a few years ago. I'd gotten some naloxone. I didn't quite know what to do with it. So I was like, do you want it for your cop cars? And he couldn't, as I recall, he couldn't ultimately take it. But we got to talk about fentanyl. He said, you know, I can maintain a supply already for my guys. I don't have it for the public. But at that point, this was several years ago, he had it in every car already for his guys. And he says, it's because quite often when my guys are clearing out a house, they might accidentally touch fentanyl, and it'll drop them. But I can't put fentanyl testing strips in with free exchanged syringes in the state of Idaho. So that's my little speech. Thanks for letting me do that.
Thanks for sharing
Not a problem.
Heard of that before.
We do have some legislators that are looking at changing that.
Last question from Debbie is, the LRC has lots of AA meetings on its schedule, but she's heard us say on the radio that there are many different pathways to recovery. And what are some of those other pathways, and do you offer them at the LRC?
I'll take the last question first. We offer them at the LRC. My job is to say yes to stuff. What we offer at the LRC is what people have come in and said, you know, I've heard about smart recovery. Could we have that at the LRC? And I got back to that guy. I said, well, they require or certified discussion lead or whatever they call them. If you can track one down, we'll put it in the calendar. I would love to have smart recovery. I would love to have Recovery International, mental health, self-help. I would love to have whatever recovery thing is. It's a matter of what people bring to us. Because what I have found is if I try and start something artificially, that's Daryl's good idea. Daryl likes it, but no group forms around it. So we have what the community has said that they want and what they have supported in the years. So we're open to all kinds of stuff.
Right. So let that be.
That's why Radio Johnny here used to help us with Artist in Residence program.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And we had free art classes. And we'll get that going again, by the way.
Yeah.
That's why we have things like Smart Recovery. But AA in particular, since she brought that up, it's so well known.
Right.
And so ingrained in locally that it's easy to have a lot of AA.
Right, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
There's a lot of McDonald's, but that doesn't mean that Wendy's is bad.
Right. Exactly. And we share on the air the program Denise is intimately involved with, which is Celebrate Recovery. That's offered over
great program
at the Real Life Church.
So Debbie asked a little bit more. That was part one of the question, wasn't it? I know what it was. She also asked, what are other routes to recovery?
Right, right.
And what I want to relay there, we based ourselves off that CCAR, Connecticut Communities for Addiction Recovery. So we based ourselves off that probably about 4 years ago now. They had a conference. In fact, they've had several conferences. I went to one of them. It was the second annual, and I think they're up to their fourth annual. Multiple Pathways to Recovery Conference. And so I was there 3 or 4 days, and they had all kinds of different pathways to recovery. They had the big ones, NA, AA, the ones you would expect, but then they had just all these like racquetball for recovery, basketball for recovery. I've heard of both of those, by the way. I'm not making them up. Wellbriety, which is a Native American-themed recovery program. They had just all kinds of them. And the point I want to make is they've had four of these conferences in it, and yes, they've repeated the big names, the AAs and the NAs, but they haven't repeated the little names. And they've had, I think it's four of these conferences now, and they're not done. Your path to recovery is your path to recovery, is the point I'm making. And it's as creative as you want to be.
Well, I think we're down to the final question, and this one goes straight at you, Daryl. Why do you still drive a 1976 Chevrolet Monte Carlo?
Because it's awesome.
Still runs, right?
Still runs.
Still runs. There you go. Why mess with anything, right?
That's right. I mean, there's...
So that was my quick answer. Long answer. I'm famous for doing quick answer and then long answer. That was my first car. I still drive my first car. I got it in 1984. I bought it for my brother. When you're 6.5 feet tall and you find a car that fits and it's not a truck, you kind of want to stick with it.
That's fair.
So lots of duct tape and baling wire there, huh?
Up until about 2009 when I totally redid it.
Oh,
it got to the point where it was either give it up or sink some money in it, because at that point it had some rust holes in it. It was my first car.
Right.
But
in
it's
Montana,
still,
yeah.
And it still ran great in 2009. I mean, really great. So it was worth investing in getting the body to look as good as it ran.
Fantastic.
So like I said, because it's awesome.
Nice.
No doubt about it. Well, that wraps up our little more than an hour. But thanks, Daryl, for coming in and giving us an update and kind of the basics.
Hey, let's do it again in a a while.
Absolutely. We're going to make this a regular feature, maybe every couple of months.
Yeah, I think that'll be a great idea.
Check in and find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we appreciate you coming and doing this.
Well, that's it for us, and thanks to our listeners out there today. And if you have any more questions, you can always call Daryl at Latah Recovery Center. Their phone number is 208-883-1045. And if you want to send them an email, you can do that at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. And I'll close with my usual. If you think you have a problem with drugs or alcohol or mental health issues, you do.